I certainly count it a privilege to be a part of this assembly this morning, to have taken part in the worship to this point, led by very capable men. I am so appreciative of all of them and proud to call them my brothers, proud to call you all my brothers and sisters. I look out over this gathering and I just can't help but think to myself, a man couldn't ask for a better family than what I've got right here. Appreciate you all so very much and appreciate these times that we have to get together and do the things that we hopefully love to do best, worship God and look into the treasure that is His Word. Looking forward to spending a few minutes this morning doing that very thing with you. I believe I've mentioned this to you before, but as I continue to grow older and as I continue to live and to study the Bible and to meditate on its message, I continue to be fascinated and amazed by the fact that God Himself once lived and walked among men for a time. That the Creator and the Sustainer of the universe actually came to earth and took on flesh and lived a life that was, well, you know, really, it was a life that in some respects was unlike any other life ever lived. We know that. But you know what? In some respects, it was just like any other life that was ever lived. I think of the words of the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, where we are told that Jesus, our high priest, can sympathize with our weaknesses because He was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Jesus was Emmanuel, God with us. And He knew what it was like to be hungry. He knew what it was like to be tired, to be frustrated, to be saddened. He knew what it was like to be tempted. You think of any experience or emotion or difficulty that humans have had to deal with as part of life on earth, and Jesus can relate. He experienced it as well. And I find great value in the knowledge and awareness of that fact. Not only that He faced life on the same terms that I face it, but that He got it right. Out of all the people, out of 100 billion people that experts tell us have lived on this earth throughout its history, only one ever really mastered life on earth, living it, as the Hebrew writer says, without sin. Well, that speaks to me of the value I can find by giving attention to the life that Jesus lived. Now, we recognize that the life that He lived was a means to an end where God's plan for the salvation of men were concerned. We understand that Jesus' primary purpose in coming to earth, as He Himself said, was to give His life a ransom for many, to pay the price for our redemption, so that we would not have to face the penalty that our sins would impose upon us. But of course, He could not have paid that price for us had He not lived that life that He lived. He was the only one who could stand on our place because He was the only one who got life right, completely 100% right. He was not the only righteous man to ever walk the earth. I like to think we've got a few righteous men in here this morning. But we think of who the Scriptures speak of as being righteous. We might think of Enoch in the book of Genesis, a man so righteous that God took him to heaven without him having to taste of death. We could think of Noah. His righteousness provided for the preservation of the human race when the world around him was so very wicked. There's Abraham, who I suppose, were it not for Jesus, would be the one man I would most like to be like. The man who is described as the father of all who have faith in Christ. We can speak of others. We can speak of men and women. We can speak of Joseph or Deborah or Moses or Sarah or Elijah and many others who could be counted as righteous, but could also be counted and are counted as sinners as well. And as they had their own sins to answer for, well, none of them could answer for mine or for yours. None of them could accomplish what Jesus did. And that was his primary purpose, as we noted, to pay that redemption price for us. But again, let me say this again, he qualified himself to do that by living a perfect life. That thought should catch our attention. None of us has to sin. I hope we all recognize that. We can resist temptation. But I know that all of us have sinned. We all have sinned against God. We have transgressed his law and continue to do so. Much to our chagrin, I hope. So we are all aware of what a challenge it is and what a challenge it can be to live through a single day without sinning. And those of us with more than a few miles under our belt know how that challenge is multiplied when we consider going 20, 30 years without sinning. And so we should thus be able to see that not only does Jesus' death have direct value for us, but the example of his life certainly should as well. You want to know how to get life right? Maybe a good idea would be to start doing some of the things that Jesus did, which is exactly what we're going to talk about this morning. The Lord expects us to live righteous lives. And if I'm aware that the Lord wants me to be doing my dead level best to be a righteous man and live a righteous life, I need to be aware that I can do no better in finding someone to pattern my life after than that of Jesus of Nazareth. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 21, Peter is speaking specifically there of the sufferings that we might have to endure in this life, but nevertheless speaks a general truth as well there, as he says that Jesus left us an example that we should follow in his steps. That makes for a better life, a life well lived. His was the model life. I believe I've said this before, but if you've ever wondered how God would live life if he had to come down and live life on our terms, you don't have to. You don't have to wonder, because that is exactly what God did. He lived that life, and he had the life preserved and documented for us so that we could benefit from that example, so that all men of all ages could benefit from that example. And this morning, I want to look at one aspect of that perfect life in a way that I hope that will benefit us and help us on our daily walk toward heaven. As I think about the life of Jesus and all the components that went into him living it, I take note in particular of a few things. One of them being the vital role that prayer held in the life of Jesus and in him living the life that he did. I wouldn't presume to speak for anyone, but from conversations that I've been in through the years and from what I've heard other people say, it does seem to me that there's quite a few people who, like me, recognize that this is an aspect of their lives that could probably always use some further development and improvement. And as would be the case with so many aspects of our lives, again, you can do no better than look into Jesus to see how to improve it. And so as I start to ponder the role that prayer played in the life of Christ, I take note of several things with regard to how he often approached times of prayer and the opportunity to pray. One thing that I'm struck by with regard to Jesus and his prayer life is that he spent a significant portion of time in what I would call significant prayer. Now, that may be a term you haven't heard before, because I think I just made it up. But anyway, what do I mean by that term? Well, I can only speak for myself, but I imagine that many, if not most of us, do pray on a regular basis. I hope that's true of everyone here. But I've got to admit that there is an ever-present danger of falling into a habit of what I would call perfunctory prayer. Prayer that is offered really just out of habit or routine, with little enthusiasm, with little thought or faith behind it. Or maybe we're not offering a prayer just out of habit, but it will nevertheless be a prayer that is rushed, because we need to get through this. We need to check all the things we need to pray for so that we can get on with life. We're busy people, aren't we? One of the ways that we can follow the example of Jesus in improving our prayer lives, and thus I believe improving our lives overall, is to make the determination that we're going to spend some time in significant prayer, in which we unhurriedly speak at length with our Father about the things that are on our mind. You know, Jesus was a pretty busy man himself. You ever thought about that, how busy he was? And he acknowledged that. In John chapter 9 and verse 4, he said, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no man can work. Now, there's a lesson right there that I think we need to think about sometimes. Jesus was aware of the limitations of time, and so he was making the best use of it that he could. He was a very busy man. His life was busy with the work that the Father had given him to do. Still, despite how busy he was, we find him making provision where necessary to ensure that he would have time to spend in significant prayer. Despite how busy he was, he made sure there would be a time when he could really focus in on this time of communion and fellowship with the Father. Think about that passage Bill read for us a moment ago over in Mark chapter 1. Jesus, in Mark 1, is at Capernaum. In the synagogue there, he's at Capernaum, you back up earlier in the chapter. And he has healed a man there who had an unclean spirit. Word of this gets out, verse 28, says that his fame spread throughout Galilee. He goes to Peter and Andrew's house, leaves the synagogue, goes to Peter and Andrew's house, where he heals Peter's mother-in-law. Word of these miracles get around in verses 32 and 33. We find all manner of people coming to him to be healed. What's the old saying? You build a better mousetrap, the word will be the path to your door. You find a man that can heal sickness, guess what? People are going to come rushing to that man. And as word gets around of Jesus' abilities, all manner of people are coming to him to be healed. And apparently, this just went on into the night. I can picture our Lord there patiently dealing with all of these people that come to him. And as I said, it goes on into the night. And when we're that busy for that long, it can be real easy to put prayer time on the back burner because I've got so many other things going on that really are good things to be involved in, aren't they? And so we'll put it on the back burner. But notice verse 35, what Jesus did about the situation. Now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. There's not a lot of people that like getting up at 0:30, are there? I bet there's not a lot of people in this room that like getting up just at the crack of dawn. That bed just feels so good that early in the morning, and it's just too easy to just lay there. And yet sometimes we do it, don't we? We'll do it because of something that's important to us that we want to make sure we get done. Maybe we want to get to that perfect fishing spot plenty early enough. Or maybe we just know we need to get to work early to get some things done that need to be done. You know, back when my kids were younger, there was one morning in December every year that they had no trouble getting up at the crack of dawn. We will do that for things that are important to us. And I think then we see from this verse what was important to Jesus in this verse. It was important to him to have time to spend in genuinely significant prayer. If the day was not going to provide an opening, well, he was going to make one. He found time, he made time for significant prayer. And not only, by the way, in doing this, did he make it a point to have the time to engage in it. I think it's interesting that he found certain places, apparently, where he could go to be alone with the Father for this. It says he went out to a solitary place here in order to do this. I mean, the kind of deep, significant prayer that I'm talking about, that I think Jesus engaged in at these times, really requires the ability to focus in on and remain focused, honestly, more than we're able to when we're driving our car. I've got no problem praying when I'm driving my car. I do it quite a bit, actually. But we can't really focus at times like that, like we really need to sometimes. Or when we're a crowd of people, or when we're doing work around the house. In the passage we just read, not only did Jesus get up early, he went to that solitary place. a place, I take it, where he understood and was aware it would be unlikely that anyone would interrupt him or hinder him in his attempt to commune with the Father in this most important way. Likewise, I think of the episode in Matthew chapter 14 after he had fed the 5,000. In Matthew 14, in verse 22, after that miracle had taken place, it says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. Again, he saw the need not only for sufficient time to pray, but the need for sufficient solitude as well at times. And I suspect that he saw the need for solitude and time because, at least in part, he recognized the need to be unhurried when he offered his prayers, when he engaged in significant prayer. Now, if you've been involved in our classes lately, you know that there are times that it is appropriate and even necessary to pray a quick prayer. I'm thinking about what we studied about Nehemiah, particularly early in that book, when he stood before King Artaxerxes, and it talks about him saying a prayer before he answered a king's question. I imagine that was a pretty quick prayer. The circumstance demanded, and I do that quite a bit myself. You know, when it comes to talking about prayer life, I can tell you, my quick prayer life is pretty consistent. I do that quite a bit. But my prayer life as a whole needs to consist of more than just quickly uttered petitions asking for something when certain needs to arise. It needs to consist of significant prayer. And that means there needs to be time when I can devote to more than just a few seconds to speaking with God, but truly commune with Him and avail myself of the benefit of this privilege. Well, that requires that there be times when I can clear my mind of anything else beyond the prayer that I am offering and take as long as it takes for me to do that as I speak to my God. In Luke chapter 6, Luke chapter 6 and verse 12, it is written there, "Now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray, and continued all night in prayer to God." Now, you want to talk about a prayer that was unhurried. Jesus goes on this mountain and prays through the night. I don't know how many hours all night encompassed that night, but it is clear that the thing that Jesus wanted to speak to his Father about at that time was something that he obviously did not want to be rushed in speaking about. He viewed it as meriting this amount of time. I'm made aware that there are things that I need to pray about that I don't need to be rushed when I pray about them. When Jesus was involved in significant prayer, he would not be rushed. And I imagine that's because of the importance he attached to the things about which he prayed. And perhaps that should be instructive to us as well. The fact that Jesus viewed important things in life as things to be prayed about. Every one of us has got what we consider to be important things going on in our lives. Every one of us who has survived into adulthood has faced significant life events that required action or maybe reaction on our part. And we're going to continue to do so as long as we live. The example of Jesus teaches me that time spent with the Father in prayer is one of the primary ways that I need to deal with a lot of these things. Consider certain important things that Jesus found it necessary to pray about. There were big decisions that had to be made. Those were important things that needed to be prayed about. That passage there in Luke 6 that we just looked at, when Jesus went up to the mountain to pray and he prayed all night, if you continue reading, do you notice what he did the next day? In the following verses, in verses 13 through 16, we are told that it was on the day that followed the night of prayer that Jesus selected from among his disciples 12 men who would be his special messengers to the world. That's a pretty significant decision that Jesus made that day. You reckon there might have been some kind of connection between that decision he made and the prayer that he prayed all night the night before. There were important decisions to be made. There were important tasks to be performed. In John 11, Jesus travels with the apostles to the village of Bethany, where he will perform a pretty sizable task. He will raise a man from the dead. And as he approached that tomb, after the stone had been rolled away, with the tears that he wept trickling down his face, verses 41 and 42, John 11, 41 and 42, tell me that Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you have sent me." Jesus is about to perform a pretty big task, and he prays about it. Big decisions, big tasks. There were big trials as well that Jesus faced. And we've all faced them too, and we will. Jesus faced a trial, quite frankly, that makes anything we face pale in comparison. But what do we find Jesus doing as that trial comes upon him? As his greatest ordeal began, how stressful was it for Jesus on the night that he was betrayed and arrested? Well, most of you have probably seen those pictures of Jesus that depict him in the Garden of Gethsemane praying. Remember, sitting on a rock with his hands resting on another rock, serenely looking up into heaven. You realize that is not the way it went down, don't you? Matthew 26 and verse 37. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." And then verse 39 tells us that he went a little farther, and you know what he did? He fell on his face. He's under extreme duress in view of what he's about to face. Luke's account in Luke 22 and 44 famously describes his sweat as becoming like great drops of blood falling to the ground. And do you know what both Matthew's account and Luke's account tells us that Jesus was doing at this time of extreme stress? He was praying. By the way, he instructed the apostles to pray as well, you know. I thought about that in the last song we sang before I got up here. You know, he told the apostles to pray. They were about to face a trial as well, you know. And he was trying to help them. He wanted them to pray that they might have the strength to deal with it. They didn't. They didn't pray. And the trial came. Jesus successfully dealt with his trial. The apostles did not. And in anticipation of the trial, Jesus prayed. And when the terrible events of the following day came about, the trial and all, as they played out, what do we see him doing? We see him praying again, even praying on behalf of those who were putting him to death. The more you get to know me, the more you're going to learn there's a lot of weird things to know about me. I'll share one of them with you right now. I am fascinated to read about how condemned criminals have faced death. I've looked up the accounts and read about the accounts of those that have been executed. And I've taken note of the attitudes that they displayed when they would enter the death chamber, and the emotions they would show, even the last words that they uttered. It's just interesting to me that rarely do you ever read about somebody praying as they die. And yet, as life slipped from the body of our Lord, that perfect example's last words were directed to the Father in heaven. "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." Even when in the midst of enduring the worst that life has to offer, and really even when the best of life has to offer is for that matter, significant prayer. Prayer and significant prayer remains a worthy pursuit. As Jesus demonstrates, things important enough to worry over or rejoice over or desire, they are things that are worth praying about, often at length. That's what Jesus did. And thinking about his prayer life, it seems to me that as helpful as it is to see the significance he attached to having the opportunity to pray, it is also helpful, I believe, to take note of some of the characteristics of the prayers that he offered. Again, Jesus was the perfect man. This perfect man attached a great deal of importance to prayer, and so I know I should as well. And knowing what I know about Jesus, I am convinced that as I seek to develop a prayer life like his, I need to take note of the mindset and attitudes that he demonstrated when he offered his prayer. Certainly we see thanksgiving in Jesus' prayers. Again, as he prayed in Bethany before he raised Lazarus, he was thankful to the Father that the Father heard him. In Matthew 11 and 25, he offered thanks for the wisdom that God demonstrated in how he chose to reveal his message to mankind. As he implemented the Lord's Supper, we read of him giving thanks for the items included in it. Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6 to be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. It is important for us to be thankful in our prayers. It is good for us as well, I believe, to be specific about what we're thankful for. I would love sometime when I'm dealing in significant prayer to go through and thank the Lord specifically for every last item in my life that I have to be thankful for. I don't think I've got the ability to do it. You know why? He's given me too much stuff, too many blessings for me to even begin to count. Nevertheless, that teaches me I need to be extremely thankful to the Father. And where I can, be specific about what I'm thankful about. The prayer life of Jesus demonstrates the importance of thankfulness in our prayers. And of course, when we think of prayer generally, we think of, well, we're going to ask God for something. We're going to make supplication for something that we would like to see happen or that we would like to receive. And that's okay. I mean, God wants us doing that as well. But I do think it's interesting that the Scriptures tell us that it would be helpful for us to consider the fervency of Jesus in his prayers as we do these things as well. We saw the fervency of Jesus' prayer in Luke 22. Where we are concerned, James tells us that we ought to be fervent in our prayers. In James chapter 5 and verse 16. Now, again, there's a specific item that James is speaking about there, and that is the forgiveness of sins. But again, I believe there is a general truth stated there as well when he says the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Not somebody that's just saying something out of rote routine, but genuinely pleading with the Lord for what they believe they need. I love it when I hear fervency in a prayer, and you can hear it. You can tell it's there when it is present. But that is evidence that the person is truly connected with what they're praying about and truly sincere in what they desire the Lord to do. Again, fervency is another thing we learn from Jesus in his prayer life, and it's good for us to emulate. We can take note of the confidence that Jesus had as he prayed. In the prayer that he offered at the tomb of Lazarus, he stated that he knew that the Father always hears him. We should remember it is never beyond the ability of God to hear us or to help us when we need it. Again in James, this time in the first chapter in verses 5 and 6, James tells us there that as we pray to God for wisdom, that we should ask in faith with no doubting. Do not doubt God's ability to hear you. Do not doubt God's ability to give you what you need. Do not doubt God's commitment to keeping his promises. Now, does that mean God will answer every prayer the way that we ask him to? Now, we've already talked about that before. He doesn't. The perspective he has on things is better than what we have. And so sometimes he will not answer in the way that we think is best, but it will be the way that is best. Nevertheless, When you pray for rain, go ahead and pack your umbrella. Have the confidence in God that Jesus had when he prayed. But at the same time, be humble enough to acknowledge that God does know best and consequently follow Jesus' example in submissiveness to the Father's will even as he prayed. Again, in Luke 22, how badly did Jesus want this burden taken away from him? Look at the duress he was enduring. And yet, as he makes his request of the Father, in verse 42 we read, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." This is the attitude we've got to have. It is good for us to make our requests known to God, but it must be with the consciousness that he knows best what is best for all of us at all times. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 14, we are told, "Now, this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us." I do believe that we will do well to spend time in significant prayer, maintaining attributes such as those that Jesus demonstrated in his own prayer life. In doing this, we will ensure, I believe, that our prayer life will bring real benefits for us. And not only for us, but I believe for those around us as well. First of all, I believe that prayer is valuable in the reminder it provides us of the presence of God in our lives at all times. Who in here has seen God? Don't you dare raise your hand. None of us have. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, he is described there as the invisible God. And you know, when you don't actually see someone or something with your eyes of flesh, it can be real easy to fall into the trap of out of sight, out of mind. And you forget that there is a God present with you at all times. But it's harder to fall into that trap if we are in the habit of speaking to that invisible God regularly and significantly, as Jesus did. Remember what James said in James chapter 4 and verse 8. If we draw near to God, he will draw near to us. The closer that we let him get to us in this way, the more we will be aware of his reality and the more that we will let him factor into our actions. Being reminded of God's presence in this way will also help us to remember, I believe, our dependence upon him. Have you ever thought about the fact that the New Testament teaches us to pray and make our request known to God, while at the same time telling us that God already knows what we need? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 8, "Your Father knows the things you need before you ask him." Keep in mind that when you are praying to God and making your request known to him, this is not a case where he needs to be reminded of you by you of the things that you need. God doesn't need reminders. But those prayers are oftentimes reminders to us of our dependency upon God and how badly we need him. And so by reminding us of his presence and our dependence upon him, I believe that emulating the prayer life of Jesus will also simply increase our faith in God. As we are reminded of his faithfulness to provide what we've needed in the past via the thanksgiving we offer him for the things that we've received, we are reminded that God is a God that we can rely upon. When I remember all the things that I need to be thankful for, I'm remembering that God has provided these things. I can rely upon him. In Luke 18 and 1, we are told that when Jesus told the parable of the persistent widow or the unjust judge or however you want to remember it, it says that he told this paragraph to teach his disciples that they ought always to pray and not to lose heart. It's as though he's saying that prayer and the loss of heart or the loss of faith, they just don't go together. And I believe that prayer is an effective preventative nature against a loss of faith and trust in God. And the overall effect of these items, the awareness of God, the awareness of our dependence upon Him, and the faith that that cultivates in us, I believe will result in the strengthening of our relationship, of our bond with God. We know that communication is necessary in any good relationship. This one is no different. God has spoken to us. Hebrews 1, 1 and 2, that's basically the message. God has spoken. God has spoken to us. If we are listening, we're going to seek out opportunities to speak to Him. And heed Paul's instruction to the Thessalonian brethren in 1 Thessalonians 5 and 17, pray without ceasing. And finally, one other thing I want to take note of that is a benefit of a prayer life like Jesus is that it is not just beneficial to us. It is beneficial to those that we care about as well. We noted James 5:16 a moment ago as we talked about the need to be fervent in our prayers. And we need to be fervent because, as James said there, the effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Prayer accomplishes things. Prayer matters. Now, I don't mind telling you, there have been times in my life, maybe you've done this, but I can tell you there have been times in my life when I was very stressed out about something. I was praying about it, but you know what else I was doing? I was looking for people to pray for me. And you know the kind of people that I was looking for to pray for me? That I would single out in my emails and my texts and my phone calls? It was people that I knew to be righteous people. I wanted that kind of person praying for me. And if I'm trying to be the kind of person that Jesus was and have the kind of prayer life that Jesus has, I am aware that that will be beneficial for those that I love. To know that when I go before God on their behalf, He will hear me. I want my prayers to be able to help others. Oftentimes, when our brethren are dealing with some difficulty, this may be all that we can do for them. In fact, Miss Louise and I were talking about this just before services this morning. Sometimes that is all that we can do for somebody. But you know what? We don't need to downplay the value of doing that for them. My highest aspiration in this life, my highest aspiration, is to be like Jesus. All the other things that I aspire to be, a good husband, a good father, a good friend, a good preacher, a good teacher, all of those things will take care of themselves, I am convinced, if I could be just more like Him. And I do pray for this every day. And I believe a big part of becoming like Jesus for all of us will involve doing the things that Jesus did. And prayer is one of those things. If we truly want to be like Jesus, we will seek to imitate Him in this regard, as well as all others. I appreciate your attention this morning. Go ahead and get ready to sing the song that Ed's chosen for us. Again, as we close things out this morning, we want to offer the invitation of the Lord to any who have need to render obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, it's an interesting thing that even in coming to the Lord to be baptized into His name is a way in which we can follow the example of Jesus. We've talked about the baptism of Jesus before, and I won't go into all the differences between what we need and what He was doing, but I'll just say this. He did it because He knew the Father wanted Him to do it. And shouldn't that be enough? The Lord desires those who believe in Him, those who wish to reap the benefits of being a disciple of His, to acknowledge Him before men, to believe in Him, and be baptized for the remission of sins. If that is your desire this morning, we can accommodate you. We have water in the baptistry sufficient to immerse you in it. If you're a child of God that's drifted from the way, we stand ready to assist you as well if it's something that requires our assistance. In any event, this will be a great first step in the road to becoming more like Jesus by obeying the gospel this very morning. If we can help you in that regard, we sure hope that you'll let us help you, even now, as we stand and sing together.
Gracious Lord, no temptation. is life.